Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, stream our show at nprnews.org/listen live every weekday at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. And on this day when George Floyd is going to be memorialized, we're going to ask what a civil rights investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department may uncover about what led to Floyd's death. Governor Walz announced it Tuesday afternoon, saying a decade of practices inside the police department will be reviewed. Public Safety Commissioner John Harrington, a former chief of police in St. Paul, said the review should be supported by the rank and file.
The cops I've worked with since 1977 to date would tell you they want change. They don't want to work in a flawed system. They don't want to have to be wearing gas masks. They don't want to have to be on riot patrol duty.
This hour, how are these investigations done? What happens when they're complete? And your questions, too. Do you think a civil rights investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department is a key step towards serious change? What do you think it will take to change the culture of the department? So I'd like to hear you weigh in this morning on whether a civil rights investigation launched on Tuesday is a key step towards serious change. And what do you think it will take to change the culture of the department overall? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. And on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Professor Nikki Jones is with us. She's a professor of African American Studies at the University of California, Berkeley, and she's with us today from Oakland, California. Professor, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
We're also going to talk with former St. Paul Police Chief Bill Finney in just a couple of minutes. Professor Jones, you heard our former St. Paul Police Chief John Harrington there, now the public safety commissioner, say officers don't want to work in an environment like this. They know that there's trouble. They know something has gone wrong. Is that often true?
Yeah, I think that's probably the case. And certainly, in my research, I've talked with officers who believe that de-escalation is the way to go, who believe that talking to people is preferable to the use of force whenever possible. But what I like people to think about is not necessarily how individual officers may think about how to use force and what the department ought to do, but to think about policing as an institution, mm-hmm. And to think about the centrality of violence to policing, and to think about, if we're thinking at a policy level, well, how do we reduce the capacity for officers to use violence in their work. And there are ways to do that. We know that there are policy interventions that can take place, but it will be very difficult to root the potential for violence out of policing entirely, because it's central to policing. And so that means that we need to have as many protections in place as possible to protect the public from the use of force.
I was watching an interview that you did on CNN, and when you talked mm-hmm. about police officers or departments being accelerants of violence, not de-escalators of violence, mm-hmm. that was kind of the first time I had heard that put that way. Explain what you mean by that, and then maybe you'll give us some context for what happens when they act in that role as accelerants.
Sure. And, the other point I made in that interview is that, what we're seeing in this moment is people just like yourself, very well-informed and good-intentioned people kind of seeing this for the first time. And this is something that many Black people, and I suspect many Black people in Minneapolis, understand already, mm-hmm. that the police can, in fact, be arbitrary. They can act in unwarranted ways. They can use their power in unrestrained ways. They can act as if they're not accountable to anyone. And this is, this is what I have also seen in my research. And so when it comes to, thinking about very basic ways in which officers can instigate violence in an encounter. And I will say that officers typically will say that civilians control what happens in an encounter. Mm-hmm. Right? So as an officer, I come to an encounter and either the civilian ratchets it up or ratchets it down. Right? But what I've done in my work with my collaborators and my research team is look at the ways in which officers can actually escalate encounters just through talk. Right. And one kind of really basic action is whether or not officers acknowledge something that a civilian is saying. Do they acknowledge when someone says to them, "I can't breathe," when a civilian has a question? And what we see is that when officers either totally ignore a person or they talk over, right, or they just issue a series of directives, then that can ratchet up an encounter, and that can increase the likelihood of the use of force. And so there are these really basic mechanisms, that can sometimes, seem invisible to a layperson or someone just observing the encounter. But it is a way in which officers control the encounter just with talk, right? Not even with force. And certainly what we've seen in videos is something that, as I said, is shocking in the kind of the disregard that some officers seem to have when it comes to using things like pepper spray and bullets against members of the public. And so in very small and large ways, officers can ratchet up encounters very quickly.
I don't want to miss what you said at the beginning of that, which mm-hmm. was because I'm white and I live in a suburban community, let's say a police officer pulls me over for speeding. It just is not, to be honest, it doesn't enter my mind that this officer is going to act in an arbitrary way that is going to potentially endanger my life, because that's just not my experience. I think you were saying many of us have not had to worry about that. We haven't been exposed to it the way these videos are exposing us. Do I have that right?
You do have that right. And then the expectation that comes from that is that, officers police in fair and unbiased ways. And what we know from recent research, I believe the Pew National Poll Trust found that 56% of officers believe that you have to be aggressive, right, in certain neighborhoods, right? And 56% of officers believe that you have to be more aggressive when policing in certain parts. In certain places. And we found that in the paper that we're working on right now, that when we interviewed officers, that officers think about places differently and they think about people in places differently. So they'll use terms like people in the projects, right, in terms like normal families, primetime civilians, mm-hmm. right? And I suspect that the neighborhood that you described that you lived in is probably a place that police orient to as a place where quote-unquote normal families
live.
For
sure.
Right? And so then you get service-oriented policing more likely, and people in the projects get more aggressive forms of policing, more dominant-oriented forms of policing. And again, right, that can make encounters, lead down a more aggressive trajectory very quickly.
Let me take some calls for you. Professor Nikki Jones is mm-hmm. with us. She's a professor in African American Studies at the University of California, Berkeley, where she does research on policing. And she's joined us this morning to talk about what this civil rights investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department really means. I want to get into a few of the specifics, like what do they do? How do we know that whatever findings they come up with and the report that they eventually issue isn't just going to be, tutted over, reported on for a couple of days and then shelved? Because a culture inside an organization, not just the police department, is really hard to change. So we'll talk about that as well. 651-227-6000 for your calls and questions. 800-242-2828 anywhere here in the upper Midwest and, of course, on Twitter. To Luke in Minneapolis. Hi, Luke.
Hi, Carrie. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Just want to touch on three quick things. Yesterday, the conversation that NPR had from 11 to 1, where you invited non-white individuals to come and share their stories and perspectives and experiences, was so appreciative.
Good.
So please continue that. To hear their pain and experience is something that a lot of us hasn't felt. So continue that conversation. Invite those dialogues. push them out there. So in regards to some things that change, let's say, two things. I think it needs to start in everyone's home, the house. How do we treat each other? Empathy, listening, being respectful. And then it goes to the street. Then it needs to go to your neighborhood. Then it has to expand out to the city, to the county, the state, the country. If we don't start in the home in terms of how we treat each other, how we talk to each other, will all be for naught. Second big point, our family lived in Toronto. Toronto's a city that has close to 5 million people. Over 50% of them are from diverse, but about 47% of them are from other countries. So we lived in an area where at midnight, we felt comfortable walking out in numerous neighborhoods. So the opportunity and the possibility for police and the public and neighbors who don't look the same to get along is available, and it's being done. I'm not saying it's perfect, but we need to look to places that it's being done. Let's not try to recreate the wheel. So leverage that.
Let me take that to Professor Jones. What do you, hear something constructive there, Professor?
Yeah, so I will say, you know, to the point of starting in your home, I think that's absolutely right. And what I heard Luke speaking to was the need for civility and discourse. But I would also push that a bit further to encourage people to think about pushing back against anti-blackness in your home as well. And that gets in very early. It gets in through media. It gets in through the educational system. And if you really want to have an understanding of what people are protesting against in this moment, it is not just the problem of policing. The problem of policing is never just about policing. It is about the persistent condition of Black people, right, in American society. And that goes back to anti-Blackness. That's explained by anti-Blackness. There's a wonderful op-ed in the New York Times this morning by Kiana Ross, who's an assistant professor at Northwestern University in African American Studies, who lays this out really well. And I would encourage people to do as much as they can once they adopt this interest and motivation to start in their home, to also be thinking not just about racism, but about anti-Blackness as well.
Professor Jones, I just want to ask you a couple questions about what happens in these investigations. I mean, do the investigators come in? Do they have full power to see all the documents they need, talk to whoever they want? I guess I'm trying to get a sense of how they uncover things that are going to be, you know, deep and get honesty right from the people they're talking to. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I think the chief will know a lot, you know, more about this than I do. But I do know something about it. And so if we, and one very, you know, good example I would encourage people to take a look at is the Ferguson report.
Yeah.
And what we learned from the Ferguson report helped to, usher and hasten, I would say, change in police reform. Once we learned about the indiscriminate stops, the vast, disproportionality in those stops, the way that the police department was relying on these stops and fines and fees for the revenue of the city. Right. So that was a deep dive. And as I understand it, the investigators are able to take that deep of a dive into the work. And certainly the Ferguson report demonstrates that. And in that regard, it can uncover the kinds of things that have been going on as business as usual. Right. And can bring that to light. And then it can enforce or strongly encourage departments to change and can use consent decrees in order to compel change on the part of departments. And so I was happy to see the pattern and practice investigation. We know that this administration scaled back those types of investigations, which is one of the few tools that the federal government has when it comes to oversight of local police departments. And I think the scaling back sent a message to police departments that the prior forms of surveillance or enforcement of police departments was unnecessary, and that they should be unleashed to do what it is that they have to do, whether it's the easy way or the hard way. And I think that's some of what we're seeing on the streets today.
Yeah, just to note what you've said, the Trump administration scaled back the Justice Department enforcement. The Obama administration, to give our listeners some context here, was active in pursuing civil rights investigations. They went, as you note, they went into Ferguson, Missouri, and New Orleans, and Cleveland, and Detroit. interesting. They got a lot of local resistance from local police officials in some of those cities who complained about the money that it cost and the intrusiveness of the investigations. I wonder how common that is.
Yeah, well, I think that certainly, you know, there are police departments that don't think that what they're doing is wrong, or else they wouldn't be doing it the way that they're doing it, and resent the intrusion or think that they can, you know, they can move toward change on their own. I will say that this administration is starkly different, not just from the Obama administration, but also from previous administrations. There wasn't really that much difference in the number of investigations, for example, under Obama or Bush. And so up until this point, it had been, you know, a pretty a bipartisan tool, right, that could be used. And certainly Obama was very committed. Obama administration was very committed to criminal justice reform. But this administration was making, you know, a political point and sending a message to law enforcement when it came to how they thought about the power of the police, certainly coming on the wakes, coming in the wake of Ferguson and the rise of Black Lives Matter. And I think that was damaging. And I would, you know,
yeah, no, go ahead.
And, you know, and the thing is that this is, you know, it's not that you get change automatically from these investigations. What they symbolize is some kind of accountability and some kind of transparency when it comes to law enforcement. And we see, you know, in some places after pattern and practice investigations, use of force goes down. In some places, it might go up. But it's one of the few tools we have. And so I think it's important to use, and it can, you know, to the extent that it is effective somewhere, it can save lives. Right. And so for those reasons, I think it's really important for these kinds of investigations to occur, especially in the wake of moments like this.
Amy says on Twitter, one basic tenet of system design is if you have good people and a bad system, the bad system wins every time. We need a full redesign and a fresh start. And another listener here says, and I'm getting a lot of calls on the union. I wanted to wait for the chief to get in on this discussion before we really take this on, but I'm hoping he's getting ready to join us. Listener says, if only the MPD police union had to pay half of the insurance cost the city of Minneapolis must carry against wrongful deaths, they would behave differently. Put that in the contract to Al in Cotton, Minnesota. Al, you're thinking about the police union here?
Yep, I sure am. I've been reading about this individual who is the head of the police union. His name is Bob Kroll, K-R-O-L-L. And folks who want to know more about him should just Google that name and read the Wikipedia article. It's a nice long list of his misdeeds as a policeman. He has more complaints on his record than Chauvin did. And they've resulted in demotions and disciplinary action of other sorts, and he's still on the force. He's still ahead of the union. And this is a guy, he has an attitude of bust heads and count them up later. Real
okay.
tough guy.
Yeah.
And
Al,
he needs to go.
I'm getting a lot of feedback on the head of the union here. Professor Jones, you obviously don't know Bob Kroll individually. I don't know how much you know about his record. But overall, what kind of an influence do police unions and their leadership play in whether a reform happens following an investigation?
So I don't know. I didn't know much about Bob Kroll before this moment. And so certainly I've learned something over the last few days, which are consistent with what your caller has cataloged. And, you know, he raises the point that many people, I think, are much more attuned now than they were 5 years ago or 10 years ago is the role of police unions in protecting officers. And it's kind of a contradiction because, you know, people can be for unions and for worker protections and at the same time look at this union and say, well, it's made it impossible to hold officers accountable for violations. Makes it impossible to hold officers accountable for things like this. It protects and protects and doesn't. And that seems to be its primary goal is simply to protect no matter what the officer has done. And so I think one of the things that we're seeing in this moment is a real focus on putting more pressure on police unions. And I think ending these contracts is going to call police unions into a different kind of conversation to the extent that institutions make certain demands that they weren't able or weren't willing to fight for before this moment.
This is a good time for us to bring former St. Paul Police Chief Bill Finney into the conversation. Chief, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
There's a lot of focus on police unions as a force of obstruction to change. Can you speak to the power of police unions at the moment and whether you do believe that there ought to be a pretty big focus on reform there, too?
Yes, I was fortunate to have the St. Paul Police Federation during my time as St. Paul Police Chief. We had challenges, and apparently they usually challenged, but normally on discipline that they felt that should be lessened or whatever. And I had my position, and on occasion we went to arbitration. Some of those I won and some of those I lost. But in general, I had a pretty workable relationship with my federation.
So, Chief, should the focus be on, I mean, there's a lot of naming the name of Bob Kroll as the head of the union and his own personal record. Again, you served in St. Paul. I don't want you to necessarily comment on his specific background, but does the leadership of a union, the police union, set the tone for either cooperation or obstruction? Or is it the nature of the union to serve its members the way we've seen the history of this Minneapolis police union do?
The leadership of a police federation or union has a great deal of impact on what direction they'll take and how they confront police management or indeed interact with city leadership. Mm-hmm. So whom a union selects for their president has a big impact.
Professor Jones, I wonder if you have any other insight in that?
What that makes me think about in thinking about Bob Kroll and what it seems to be, mm-hmm. you know, that he stands for and that the membership is voting for this leader, it suggests, I think, some deep-rooted problems and a culture you alluded to at the top of the show. Some deep-rooted cultural problems with the department's membership that are perhaps battling and thinking about the reforms that have taken place in Minneapolis over the last several years, battling, you know, against a group of officers who may want to actually see change.
Chief, the other thing that when we were talking about culture, I'm wondering about how you set the tone for the culture at the top. And I'm thinking again about what Police Chief Extell said after this video became public last week. He said that he challenged his officers to look at that video, and if any of them believed that the officers had acted in the proper way, then they could go get a new career. They didn't need them on the force. Easier said than done. So how do you set a cultural tone, you know, for an organization where they're going to be out on the streets, you can't monitor their every move? What do you do?
Well, you know, the system of how a chief is selected and the tenure of a chief is very important. When you have stable, solid police administration that doesn't change frequently, they can set a tone, they can set a culture, they can create policy, they can establish training, they can ensure that proper supervision of police officer actions go unchallenged. St. Paul, in my time at St. Paul Police Department, which was almost 34 years, there were only three police chiefs, and I was the third one.
Huh.
I was a chief for 12 years. The chief before me was there for 12 years. The chief before that was there for 10 years. So when you have stable leadership and you're not constantly changing the top, you know, officers know what the rules are, because they're trained in those in the police academy. They know how they're going to be enforced. They know what the leadership expects. When they cross the line, what's going to happen? What are the consequences? It's very important to have stable police leadership. Now, that leadership has to understand what the expectations are of city leadership and what the general expectations are for the people of whom you are sworn to protect. In the city of St. Paul, I was born and raised in, so it's easy for me to understand what people in St. Paul expected out of their police department. So I had that going for me. I didn't come from the outside. I was an insider. So that's very, very important.
Professor Jones, that's pretty interesting, isn't it? How much do you think it matters that a chief comes from the neighborhood of the city that they are policing, that they're leading?
Well, I think that the chief has to know something about, certainly, the neighborhood in the city. I don't know... by and large, how much, you know, coming from the city itself matters, and we see police coming from outside all the time. But I do think it's most important for the chief to be trusted and for their voice to matter. But at the same time, policing happens after officers leave roll call. They go out into the world and they police. And right. certainly the culture of the department has some impact on that. But, you know, just, you know, going back to what I mentioned at earlier in the show, is that there are ways that officers think about policing that don't on the face of it seem racist, but are certainly, you know, reflect ideas, different ideas about different people. And so much of this is tied into space. And so you can be, you know, an officer who believes that they're doing a good job and believes that, well, in this neighborhood, this is how you have to talk to people. And this is how you have to treat people, because that's actually what good policing means. Right? And so I don't want people to kind of miss that
right.
distinction, because we get easily into thinking about, you know, good officers and bad officers. And so, you know, there is what can be seen as the expertise of officers that is, in fact, seems to be race neutral, but can be in reality. You know, can make it so that people have very different experiences with the police.
Yeah, Chief, I'm really glad Professor Jones brought that up again when you were on the show. Is she right?
About the culture of the department?
No, about how police officers go into certain areas of the city with different expectations, and that changes the way that they're going to interact with the public and the kinds of tactics that they're going to use. And nobody is going to stand up at roll call and say, well, this is, you know, we're going to break some heads in this neighborhood. I don't care whether we see any, you know, crimes or not, but that it emerges in a subtle way, and the way you see different methods of policing in different places.
It's common within a police culture. To when a rookie officer comes out of police academy, they learn all the things they're supposed to learn, all the things that are, quote, according to Hoyle. And then they go into a field training process. So they actually work alongside a veteran police trainer and are evaluated on how they do their job on the street. Often, if you have the wrong FTO, field training officer, if you have the wrong ones or other veterans out there say, hey, kid, forget about what you learned at academy. This is how we do stuff out here on the street.
Interesting. Yeah.
That's a very, very powerful indoctrination to a culture. Police officers, new police officers, want to be accepted by their counterparts, by those veterans that came on before them. And sometimes, if you don't have close police scrutiny or supervision oversight on that, and this is where the police first line supervisor becomes very, very important, that they get the message of the administration and that they counteract or oversee the officers in their practices that don't go astray. It's very, very important for supervision. Often we overlook that, and we don't hear enough about that in terms of police management. First line supervisors are very, very important, but there's that overall group pressure. Groups of officers and sometimes veteran officers who've decided they've worked a particular area of the city a certain amount of time think they know more and they're going to do it their way. And they sit down at coffee shops or whatever and say, hey, kid, you want to be part of us? This is how we do things out here. That's a very real deal. Now, that culture sometimes in one department is more pervasive than it is in other departments, but it is a cultural issue. And each police department has its own kind of unique culture.
Former St. Paul Police Chief Bill Finney is with us this morning, and Nikki Jones, a professor in African-American studies at the University of California, Berkeley, where she does research on policing, is also with us. As we contemplate this civil rights investigation that has been launched into the Minneapolis Police Department, we've asked some questions about how this investigation is actually done, whether there is cooperation from the rank and file and the leadership. What happens to these reports? Because they have been done in many other cities. And your calls and questions about what it will take to change some of the cultural elements of this. You just heard Chief Finney talking about how important field training officers are to that. He's talking about culture there. What are you thinking about that as you listen? Just want to read this from Kayla. She says, my father-in-law is a retired parole officer. His old beat was in East St. Paul on Arcade Street. In all his years, he never carried a weapon. He could have, but he chose not to. He had multiple weapons shoved in his face throughout his career, but he learned the power. We'll get a look at the latest news when we come back. More of your calls and questions. Phil Picardi, what are you leading with this hour?
Hi, Carrie. Demonstrations in cities across the U.S. continue to condemn racism and police abuses after the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. In New York, a protest turned violent when four officers were allegedly attacked by a man wielding a knife. One officer was stabbed in the neck and two others were shot in the hand before the man was shot and wounded. The injured are expected to survive their wounds. In New Orleans, police released tear gas on hundreds of demonstrators who pushed past a line of police officers to cross a Mississippi River bridge. Nearly 2 million people applied for U.S. unemployment benefits last week. That's evidence many employers are still cutting jobs, even as a gradual reopening of businesses has slowed the pace of layoffs. The total number of people who are receiving jobless aid rose slightly to 21.5 million. That's down from a peak of nearly 25 million 2 weeks ago. The UN and Red Cross and Red Crescent are urging governments to unite in developing a people's vaccine to protect against the coronavirus. The appeal comes ahead of a vaccine summit in London organized by the Global Vaccine Alliance, which is seeking to mobilize billions of dollars of funding for a vaccine. The urgency of finding a new way to stem outbreaks is evident as India reports another record number of new infections, more than 9,300 in a 24-hour period. And thousands of people in Hong Kong defied a police ban and broke through barricades to mark the 31st anniversary of the crushing of a democracy movement centered on Beijing's Tiananmen Square. Crowds in the former British colony lit candles and observed a minute of silence to remember the 1989 crackdown. Police cited the need for social distancing during the pandemic in banning the vigil at Victoria Park. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:39.
America feels like it's on the verge, but of what? Lies, conspiracy theories, and false information are running rampant online. Some of those working for the platforms pushing this garbage out are now walking out. I'm Celeste Headlee, the price we all pay for tolerating untruth. Next time on 1A.
1A starts at 10 a.m. here on NPR News.
I'm Marianne Combs. Communities of color are reeling from the killing of George Floyd and the ensuing neighborhood destruction. Today on Counterstories, we talk about grieving, healing, and rebuilding. Join us for that conversation at 11.
We did a 90-minute show yesterday with Health Commissioner Jan Malcolm, Infectious Disease Director Chris Ayersman, about the pandemic in Minnesota, what the effect of the protests may be, what happens in the fall with schools and businesses. If you need to take that in manageable bites, you can do that. You can listen to the podcast, listen to 30 minutes, go do something else, come back and listen to the other two 30-minute segments. You can find it by searching NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you listen to podcasts.
Support comes from Minnesota Oncology. With more than 100 cancer care providers, Minnesota Oncology offers access to the latest evidence-based treatment paths, 12 close-to-home locations, and comprehensive services to support the whole person. More at mnoncology.com.
Support comes from the Minnesota History Center, now presenting online access to exclusive video content from the First Avenue exhibit. Take a video tour of the club, watch interviews, and go behind the scenes at mnhs.org.
Back to our conversation now with Chief Bill Finney. He's a former St. Paul Police Chief and currently Undersheriff for the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office. And Nikki Jones is with us, a professor in African American Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. To the phones here to Victor in Minneapolis. Victor, thanks so much for waiting. What did you want to add here?
Thank you so much for this conversation. I mean, this is really important, and thank you so much for the coverage. I had a question about what Professor Jones mentioned about 20 minutes ago. She said that in the research, she found 56% of cops, police officers, thought that, yes, they needed to approach a neighborhood with a certain amount of force. Of those 50%, I'm curious how many of them actually lived in those communities that they're policing. This kind of goes into that whole culture conversation that Chief Finney's also talking about now.
Yeah.
I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you. Professor Jones, do you know that?
No, I that was not research that I conducted. That was a national poll that was conducted. And so it should be available. It is available online, and that information may or may not be there. But this question comes up again and again, you know, would officers behave differently if they lived in neighborhoods? And I just want to encourage us to think, you know, to push our thinking on what kinds of solutions, you know, are likely to be most impactful. And so certainly there's a way in which officers are socialized to see the public differently, right? In my experience, there's a kind of suspicion about the public that's, you know, writ large. And then, you know, that is, you know, even more so when it comes to Black people and people of color. But what we're dealing with is an institutional problem that is not easily solved just by living in that place. Even if they're living in that place and they are socialized into this institution that encourages and see themselves as apart from the public, you are still going to have that kind of distance. And so I just really like us to kind of, you know, in thinking about what solutions might be, that we're mirroring the depth of the problem.
Good.
As it is.
Not going to something simple like, this is the answer. Cops have to live in the neighborhoods that they patrol.
Well, Chief,
go ahead.
I have an opinion on
that.
I have an opinion on that. I think that, in the St. Paul Police Department, I would think you'll find that majority of the police officers live outside the corporate city limits. Mm-hmm. When I came on the police department, it was encouraged. In fact, if you got hired, you had to move in the city within the first year. The legislature, in its wisdom, decided that, we can't say that anymore. We can't make people live where we want them to live. Now, if Bill Finney were king, I would say that anybody that draws a public check, if you work for city services and you get paid by a city, you should live in that city. If you're married to somebody who works in another city, you should have to live in one of the other two cities. I do believe that when you're part of it, when you see it, when you feel it, when you're in and around it every day, and you want to go out and be a service provider, a deliverer of services, particularly in the public safety sector, when you have that understanding, when you feel that, you are more fully invested in how you deliver your service and how your counterparts and your peers deliver their service. I've seen changes in my life. Now, it's not scientific. It's just observational from a guy that was working in the field and still continues to work in the county, Ramsey County, that I just believe that when you work in and around and live in an area, that you have a more vested stake in how the outcomes of that community are.
Chief, you think that encourages diminishing the us and them, the distance that Professor Jones was talking about, even though we know that that's often racialized?
Well, there is a racial component, and the earliest history of police departments or how patrol was established was racist. And it remained very, very racially focused up through and including, some may argue, even today. Not as much as when I began in law enforcement, and I began in law enforcement in 1969, but up until the time I left, it was still there, less pervasive than it was in 1969, but yet still there. My belief is that in living in and amongst people, and when I take a look at the demonstrations that are going on now, mm-hmm. And I see who's out there demonstrating. And I look at that wonderful grouping of people that reflect the diversity of the cities of America. I fully support the demonstrations. I do not support violence, nor the destruction or the looting or the criminality that goes on. But the right to demonstrate is in the greatest traditions of this country, the First Amendment of America under our Constitution. The right to do peaceful demonstration is there. Sometimes those get loud. Sometimes they get disruptible. But that is America. That is America. And that is how the beginning of the discussion to make change happens.
Call here from Molly in St. Paul. Hi, Molly.
Hi.
What are you thinking about?
I know it comes down to a lot of open conversations between blacks and whites. And I think those conversations are difficult, especially I think white people think they're going to say the wrong thing. And that sort of stops conversations. Mm-hmm. So I think in order to, you got to allow for those mistakes to break through some of those racist opinions a lot of people have of like the black culture. That's all I just like to hear their opinion on that.
Yeah. Professor Jones.
So one thing that I like to encourage people to think about in this moment, and I think over the last 5 years, there's been a lot of talk about having conversations, you know, cross-racial conversations. And there's also people, you know, who have said that, you know, white people really need to take on this project of education on their own, and not just a project of education, but a critical education. And you need to do that before you come into conversation with black people, not, you know, expecting that black people are going to do the work for you. And so, you know, that's what I, you know, would encourage people to do. And understand and also reflect on that it's very likely that you are having trouble with this conversation, even though you probably have a really good education, right? Or what you thought of was a really good education. Mm-hmm. Right? And so we have to think about our education system as well. And again, the anti-blackness that's rooted in that education system that people come to take as kind of normal and how the world works. And then they see this moment and they're not able to understand it, right? And at the same time, there are a large group of people who are able to understand it right away.
From Twitter, we need to change the structures in which policing is deployed. That will require a change in our culture, i.e. people and institutions. We'll need to reexamine what public safety is. Chief, there's been a lot of discussion, years ago, over the last few years, about the militarization of police departments. How do you feel about that? Is that a place to look here?
Well, a lot of people will say militarization. Often that means different things to different people. When they look at some of the equipment that we've had, we now carry from our sidearms to some of the long guns to some of the other vehicle equipment that we use. These things are in response to what's going on out there in the community. We changed from the old sidearm, from the old six-shooter revolver, to the pistol that holds more bullets because when I started, there used to be a two-man squad, literally two men that worked a squad car. This is back in the days before we felt that women were qualified to do the same job. Mm-hmm. But we carried six shooters. And so you had an individual that was covered by a partner. That gave way to the single officer squad car with the old six shooter and no backup at hand readily. So we started encountering people that had better firearms than the police were using, and using those firearms against members of the public and indeed against the police department. We changed to different firearms. We changed from a shotgun in the squad car to rifles because we're starting to find people that were also arming themselves with bulletproof vests, those that were committing serious crimes. Police officers were unprepared for that. So different things change. We started getting offers from the federal government on equipment that police departments couldn't afford.
Yeah.
Trucks, sometimes armored vehicles, things like that were needed in certain SWAT applications. So to that degree, the militarization, very visible became also very necessary for the safety of police officers to attend to the expectation that the public had of quieting the active shooter or whatever shooters are out there. Now, with that, we had to be very careful about not adapting military-type tactics that perhaps the Army, whatever, would use when confronting a foreign enemy. So that's where leadership, stable leadership, becomes very, very important to a police department. Officers have to know what is expected. They have to know what they're be held accountable for. And that comes from the chief. Only the chief of police, or what we call the chief law enforcement officer in Minnesota, be the chief, be it a sheriff, be it a commissioner, be it a superintendent, whoever that chief law enforcement is, they're the only ones that can apply discipline to police officers.
Mm-hmm.
So officers in Minnesota have this thing that's guaranteed by the state called the Officer Bill of Rights. When a person makes a complaint against them, they have a right to know what the specifics are of the complaint and who it is specifically is complaining against them. So there's a lot of protections for police officers. Some might argue, rightfully so. I would arguably, yes, to a certain degree. But when they get outside of the community expectation, when they get outside of what they're being told they should do, then they have to be held accountable. When they break crimes, they break laws, they commit criminal acts, they have to be fully accountable.
Professor Jones, what are you thinking as you listen to what the chief is saying?
Yeah, and so one thing I'm thinking is about the militarization and how it grows in the wake of moments of crisis. And so certainly after the wars on drugs and wars on violence in the 80s and 90s and after 9/11. But then what happens is you have this militarized police force, and who are they interacting most with most often, right? So they're interacting with people in black neighborhoods and poor black neighborhoods. And that same kind of militarization then bleeds into routine policing, right? And that's where it's going to have, the most impact and the most damaging impact. I could think about my work and videos from the neighborhood where I studied, where you see police officers beat officers walking down the street with AKs across their chest.
Jeez.
And there's no immediate crisis. Like they're walking in a nonchalant way down the street, and that's sending a message to everyone in the neighborhood. And that's what makes people feel as if they're living with an occupying force. Right, not with a force with legitimate authority. And so I think when it comes to demilitarization, we have to push on that, because on a day-to-day basis, right, it's having a very damaging impact on people who come into contact with the police most often.
Chief, we had a call here, and then Chris had to drop. But what he wanted to ask you was, if you think that prosecuting the accompanying officers, the officers that were involved along with Officer Chauvin, will send a powerful signal to the rest of the police force that they're responsible for the actions of their colleagues. Chris adds, will that be a powerful deterrent for future misbehavior? I think this is a good question, Chief. What would you say?
Absolutely.
Yes?
Absolutely. Yes, I think it will be a deterrent. If you remember, just recently, I can't remember what city it was in, but there was another police officer. He and his partner had an individual down, and his knee was close to the man's neck, and his partner snatched his leg and pulled it back over to his back. You think that wasn't because of what happened to Mr. George Floyd? Absolutely it was. It has a very, very powerful impact. Should officers be held accountable? Absolutely. They have a job to enforce the law, but more importantly, they have a job to protect the public's safety, to be a public safety official. We enforce the law in order to ensure that the public's safety is kept. So that means protecting the individual as well as the general population. And every officer swears to do that. They raise their right hand and they swear to uphold the laws, to enforce them equally, and to protect the public's safety.
But Chief, the other thing we, but if I might, the other thing we hear is that there is a strong culture of you know, superiority and to a certain degree, silence. If your superior is behaving in that way, you are not to interrupt or interfere with that. And you will protect, you know, especially if there's no videotape, you'll protect what has occurred.
Well, in today's world, you never know if there's any videotape because there are cameras everywhere. But the point of enforcing and charging those other three officers drives home the main point, is that you too are culpable for the actions of somebody who's behaving illegally. And if you don't act to stop that illegality, then you too will be responsible and held accountable criminally. And so these things have an impact, and they'll have an impact on culture. It'll take a while, but I think these things have an impact.
What, Professor Jones, I have about 2 minutes. What do you think?
Sure. I would say that if institutions, if law enforcement institutions don't hold officers accountable, don't hold themselves accountable, then you create the conditions for abolition. And one of the things that I think is important to highlight in what's happening in Minnesota is you see these abolitionist actions emerging. You see the University of Minnesota severing their contracts with the police. You see the Minneapolis School District severing their contract. The park organization said those are whether or not they would describe them as such, those are abolitionist actions, defunding, divesting, and hopefully investing in other institutions that actually will serve more directly public safety and public well-being. And I think that when we think about, you know, whether or not protests are effective, what will happen from this moment, I see those, that is one of the areas where we moved forward most quickly, is in thinking about things like defunding, divesting, and investing.
This was a really, I think, a really informative and insightful conversation. I'm grateful to you both. Chief, thank you so much for being with us.
Anytime.
Professor Jones, I'm really grateful you had the time for us this morning. I know it's early out there in California, but I'm glad you could do it.
Thank you. I appreciated the conversation.
Nikki Jones is a professor in African American Studies at the University of California, Berkeley, and she does research on policing. And of course, Bill Finney is a former St. Paul police chief. He's the undersheriff for the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks for listening.